Welcome to the Inside OSU podcast. I'm Robin Hearn. In April of 1968, America was rocked by the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It was a divisive and tragic time for our country. In the middle of the chaos, two Oklahoma State students, one black, one white, both friends, traveled by car through the segregated South. Harold Fields and Keith Montgomery were in Atlanta when Dr. King was assassinated. On today's podcast, Harold and Keith sat down with OSU President Burns Hargis to describe their journey. It's an unfiltered look through a turning point in American history.
Let's go back to 1968. And, of course, Martin Luther King was assassinated on April 4th in Memphis. But you two were together in Atlanta at that
Right.
time, were you not?
That's right.
Why were you in Atlanta?
We were both in Omicron Delta Kappa,
right.
ODK, and there was a national convention for ODK in Atlanta. And the OSU chapter of ODK didn't have enough money to, they wanted to send representatives to the conference, but didn't have enough money to pay for airline tickets or whatever. So Harold and I drove from Stillwater to Atlanta to attend that convention. That was it.
I see. And went together?
Yes.
Yeah, we drove together.
Yeah.
We had to plan an itinerary that was we thought would be safe because, you know, just a few years before there were the Freedom Riders and just a lot of violence throughout the South. So we were pretty concerned about, I couldn't stay in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And so we drove straight through.
Did you go through Memphis?
No, we didn't.
No. The interstate system wasn't complete at that time.
Right.
And so we ended up taking a diagonal path down from Arkansas into Mississippi and Alabama. We drove all night. We left evening, I guess, of the 2nd of April, and we drove all night, and the next morning we'd been hesitant because we weren't sure of the safety issues
Sure.
of the black and white traveling together in the Deep South, and so we were very careful about stops at night, and we saw a Holiday Inn in just outside of Gadsden, Alabama. We thought, well, it's a national chain, surely that's safe. We stopped for breakfast. It was about 7:30 in the morning. I had traveled in the South with my family, where you're greeted with all this Southern hospitality, good morning, how are you, and all
yeah,
of this
sure.
friendship. But in contrast, when Harold and I walked in, we were met with silence. And the hostess sort of stared at us. We said we were there for breakfast. She picked up two menus without saying a word, walked us across the dining room to the furthest removed from any other patrons, placed the menus in front of us and turned around and walked away. A short time later, a waitress came up, and again, it was the mute treatment. She stood there silently holding an order pad, and we assumed that that meant she was ready to take our orders, and so we both ordered. I had noticed that the hostess had been on the phone after she went back to her hostess stand, and before our food arrived, two Alabama state troopers came in with some local man. And she led them, the hostess led them across the restaurant, sat at the table next to us. And as she placed menus in front of them, she said, "Did you all notice who you're having breakfast with this morning?" And one of the state troopers, and this was obviously for our benefit, and there was a state trooper just to my right, and I couldn't help but notice the large pistol on his hip, and he said, "Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, we shouldn't have to give them food, shelter, or nothing." And the other one then said, "Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, their biggest problem is going to be getting out of this state alive." And so that was our introduction to the Old South, if you will.
Well, actually, I think before we got there, driving through Mississippi, on some of the local roads, when you get off the four-lane highway and those stretches where you had to go through local towns, one of the things I noticed was that there were stop signs on top of stop lights. It made me very nervous because I realized that that was there to catch anybody with popping out of state license plate. And if you went through the green light, you could be pulled over and the question would be, "Hey boy, why'd you run that stop sign?" For local control and selective enforcement. You know, I was just really on pins and needles
sure.
driving that whole time.
You got to Atlanta, hopefully without further incident, and so you would have gotten there on the 3rd?
We got there in the evening, I guess, late on the 3rd, and the conference started the next morning, the 4th. Mm-hmm. It was well attended. Ivan Allen, who was the mayor of Atlanta, addressed us, and that toward the end of the day, and there were meeting discussion sessions, and Harold and I were in the same one, and there was a student walked in, ashen-faced. He was, I believe, from Memphis State. I'd met him earlier in the day, and he very somberly said, "I've just been told that Dr. King has been shot in our city." And
was that
sort of
late afternoon?
This was, this was what, 5:30 somewhere?
Something
there.
Like that. Yeah.
And it didn't immediately register our city. What were we talking about? And it became clear he was talking about Memphis, and by that time, everyone knew that King had been killed. We were, I think, shocked, stunned. It was it was one of those situations where you're not sure how to even react, because the news is just, and you're trying to process what it means for the King family, for yourself, for the country, and so forth. I mentioned earlier that the OSU chapter of ODK didn't have a lot of funds, and so to conserve, Harold was very good at keeping records and watching the money, and so we were staying at a YMCA. And so we left the conference and went back to our small little room at the Y. There was no television. Harold had a portable radio, and we started listening on the radio to what was going on.
Back then, I mean, that was the same time I was in school, although I confess I'm a year older than Harold anyway, two years older than Keith. Even, I mean, segregation was alive and well in 68. I mean, your friendship would have been a little unusual at that day. How did that happen, Harold?
Well, I think Keith and I met probably over at University Heights Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. I was attending University Heights and very involved, and I was one of the student leaders there, and then
is that a integrated church?
University Heights is across the street from the old campus theater on Knobloch.
Right.
And it was, well, I was the integration at that church.
Is that right?
Yeah. There were only maybe just a handful.
Yeah.
But I was singing in the choir and very active with the student groups.
Right.
But I, even though in Tulsa I went to a segregated school system, being a student council president, I was involved with the student council presidents from all the other high schools.
Yeah.
So I'd been collaborating with white colleagues, quite a bit. And I was pretty comfortable with interacting and with all kinds of people.
Yeah.
So it was, Keith and I, we served on the Senate together, and so we did a number of things together over time.
When I went to school, or I came here to school, at that point I didn't know a single African American by name. There were no blacks in Collinsville. There were a few Cherokee Indian families, a few Hispanic families, but no blacks. And I didn't understand at the time, but Collinsville had been one of those sundown towns where the unspoken rule, and sometimes it was actually written on a billboard
apparently
outside
Norman
of town,
had a sign like
that basically told blacks that they were not to be present in town after sundown.
Right.
And so the result of that for Collinsville, which as I say was only 20 miles north, is that neither the town nor even the surrounding rural area were there any black families. And so when I met Harold at University Heights Baptist Church, it was the first black person I had known by name. We had interaction over time, but that during that trip is when we really got to know each other because of the circumstances
sure.
we found ourselves in.
Sure, adversity has a way of bonding people.
Right.
So let's go back then to April 4th, of 1968. After you heard the news, what happened? I mean, were there riots in the city?
Atlanta didn't have riots. It was very calm. We noted that. We noticed that as we drove around the next day. I think we went to some morning meetings and then spent time trying to see more of the city and trying to
go by his church.
We actually did go to the church, and we sat near the back pews, and was doing prayer services. I think Daddy King was conducting that service and greeted us as we were leaving. We actually tried to go to the funeral home, and they wouldn't let us in.
Yeah.
You know, we were pretty adventurous since we're out there. Going to Ebenezer was sort of a high point in terms of being in the middle of things for us.
So then you mentioned you had some incidences and concerns driving to Atlanta. Mm-hmm. There were riots in various places around the country.
Right.
And at some point, when did you head back to?
Well, actually, we left Atlanta and then went to Charlotte, North Carolina. Took a little side trip because I had a girlfriend in Charlotte.
Oh, really?
We didn't call ahead. We just kind of showed up on her doorstep. She wasn't there at the time. She was at a church meeting. And her mother was real surprised to see this white boy standing on the porch, because Charlotte was, it was very tense in Charlotte. And there were things going on in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. So Keith got a little sleep. And while I visited with my girlfriend at the time.
Take it, it's not the girlfriend you married.
It's not the girlfriend that I married, that's right. But when we were leaving Charlotte, I had to cover Keith with a blanket to get him out of the black neighborhood, because there was fighting and rioting going on right there. So we did actually come close to a lot of that activity. And on the way back, passing by Memphis, we couldn't get off the highway at Memphis. It was blocked off, and so we had to keep going around there.
Harold was describing getting out of Charlotte. I've told him that he probably wanted to throw a blanket over me earlier to keep me quiet or something, but I was literally on the floorboard on the passenger side with a blanket over, because we were afraid we'd get a brick through the window of seeing a white face.
Yeah.
But before I did my submarine act, there were fire trucks and so forth, and sirens everywhere. There was visible smoke and flames in the distance.
This was in Charlotte.
In Charlotte.
Not in Atlanta.
And so, now Atlanta, as Harold said, Atlanta was quiet. It was almost unique among major cities. It was as if there Dr. King's message of nonviolence actually meant something. But we heard these stories, and in fact, one of the students that was with us when we went to Ebenezer Baptist Church, his brother was trapped in an office building in downtown Washington, D.C., because of the proximity to the rioting that was going on there. And so we were hearing these reports that sounded like cities and even the nation was sort of coming apart at the seams with all of this violence, but Atlanta was the exception.
So when you left Charlotte, did you head back to Stillwater?
We made a stop in Nashville, mm-hmm. and visited with the former pastor of University Heights, Bill Sherman, Dr. Sherman, and his family, and went to a service with them. They were just dear, wonderful people that we wanted to stay connected to, and we took the opportunity to see him, because he had just recently left and moved to pastor a church in Nashville.
The church he was pastoring was Woodmont Baptist, which was a large sort of upper middle class church, and the Southern Baptist Convention is based in Nashville, Tennessee, and a lot of employees and officers of the Southern Baptist Convention mm-hmm. attended that church. Nashville was under a curfew, a 6 o'clock curfew, so one of the first things they did at the service that morning was announce that there would be no evening services because of the curfew. And people were understandably on edge. And so here, Harold and I walk in and sit with the pastor's family. Harold's the only black face in the congregation. One of the most memorable parts of that was that the Sherman son, who was about three at the time, had known Harold from being in Stillwater, and he curled up on Harold's lap and went to sleep. His father, Dr. Sherman, interrupted his sermon when he looked down and saw that. When he directed his attention to Harold, the congregation's attention was directed in that way. And there was this audible sigh. I mean, it was just this collective reaction, like there was some sense of relief.
That's the way it ought to be.
Yeah.
That must have been remarkable.
It was. It sounds like that was really comfortable, but I'll tell you that when you have to travel and you have to count to see how many other people are like you, you don't really feel safe and secure.
Right.
And you're sort of on guard a lot. And I'm sure that happens in schools and other places where people are not in the majority. And there's a certain amount of tension that comes with just existing in those environments.
So did you then proceed on back, or were there further incidences?
No. The incidents that happened in Arkansas were on the way out. We drove through extreme thunderstorms and didn't find out till the next day that we had driven through a swarm of tornadoes. So much lightning that you didn't even need headlights because there was so much activity. And fortunately, we didn't know that. But I'll tell you, the other thing is that during the days before cell phones, we couldn't be in communication with people very easily. And our parents didn't know we had taken this trip. When we first got to Atlanta, I think one of the first things I did was got some postcards and made some notes and sent them postcards, which they didn't get until after the assassination and couldn't call me because I wasn't in the dorm. I called them when I got back, and they were just going crazy. Where are you? Are you okay? What were you thinking? It was very interesting coming back. But when we got back, we learned that there was a fraternity that was having a picnic, a celebration at Lake Carl Blackwell, celebrating the death of King.
Oh, my word.
So it was kind of hard to come back, a place where there were people who were, supporting what was going on with James Earl Ray.
We had, one of the things you asked earlier about our friendship, that during this trip, Harold and I, after the encounter with the Alabama State Troopers, spending the next 20 minutes looking out the back window to make sure we weren't being followed, that began the prolonged conversation that lasted basically the rest of the trip about various matters related to race, where we explored the difference between what I had never really thought about before. I mean, one of the things about being a teenager in America at that time, and if you live in an all-white town, race is, sort of some issue that affects people somewhere else. Harold and I both had educated parents. We were probably barely middle-class kids in Oklahoma. Both of us had been student leaders in our high schools, and so there were many, and we'd both been raised Baptist. There were many similarities, but there were also, we began to explore all the differences in the ways that we grew up, the way that what we expected of the way we would be treated by other people, some of the not the more overt, outrageously racist, and obviously racist acts, but many of the more subtle differences that, at least for me as a naive white kid, I had never really thought about.
You're going to that white church reminds me of, I used to work in television in Oklahoma City, and we had a African-American reporter said something very profound. I thought it was right after the O.J. verdict. The O.J. Simpson's verdict came out, and he said, "This is the most segregated moment in this country, except for Sunday morning," which I thought was a pretty interesting observation. And our law firm was—I can remember a lot of the administrative people were of color, and the white lawyers were, I can't believe that, and we didn't have any black lawyers, mm-hmm. but they were actually applauding it in the, mm-hmm. in the admin room. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I realized that if you think yeah. that we don't still have work to do.
The fact that we are such a segregated society is not an accident. It is by government policy that segregation was created in housing. When the government, during the time after World War II and people were building the suburbs, there were government policies that would not allow blacks to buy homes in certain areas. And we're giving subsidies to whites and then taking things away from blacks. So these were government policies that created this all over the country. And we haven't recovered from that very much because those differences and the gaps seem to get wider. But there's a middle class that seems to have benefited from the civil rights movement, but then there's an underclass that mm-hmm. was created. So we have to look at race and class and figure out how to address those things.
Special thanks to Harold and Keith for sitting down with President Hargis to tell their story. That's all from this week's Inside OSU podcast. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. I'm Robin Hearn. Thanks for listening.